system. Because as we go through this, I found as I tried to write some of these things, you read in a report or something that they put in the dollar well, or maybe they joined the aft interfaces, and you wonder, how the hell did they do that? And we really don't know at this point.
To get back to the alternate common bulkhead study, that Marshall felt that the North American design, the one that is currently used, wouldn't be successful. And so there's a parallel development, which they asked North American to do, which they separately funded under a different contract.
No, that's not, best of my recollection, that isn't true. North American method was developed, that was a sucking the bulkhead to a slightly larger size and dropping it on. That was a joint development between us at the beginning of the beginning of the program. The bulkhead where we did the parallel studies was the Douglas S4B bulkhead, or the S4 bulkhead. It was the 18-foot bulkhead, where three approaches were tried. One was, let me think. One was the standard approach with two-phase sheets put together. One was with one welded phase sheet and segmented phase sheets on the hydrogen side with bonded doublers. And one was completely segmented bulkhead where you put the honeycomb between the phase sheets in segments like slices of a pie and then weld the pie pieces together, top and bottom. And that didn't work no how.
That's what North American ended up doing.
North American shaped, North American machined the honeycomb and tried to make the honeycomb perfect and dropped the, it had two welded skins which they applied to
in
the
segments.
Honeycomb. They made them in segments and welded them, and then when they had a complete dome, they put it on.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is you make complete pieces with two skins on, then you weld it together after you've got the honeycomb bonded between the segments.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work.
Did you do a lot of development of work using programmed machines for milling and tooling, things of this type?
Well, they came in more and more during the program. Most of the, I don't think that in the stages there was that much. There was quite a lot of NC machining, but I think in the thrust structure and areas like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think mostly the skins were milled using tracer machines as opposed to NC machines.
Mm-hmm. And something else too, that the magnetic hammer.
Ah, yes, the magnetic hammer.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about the magnetic hammer? How it came about, how it developed, how it was used?
The magnetic hammer was developed largely before I got here. But there's a curious story about this too, but I've got no place in this.
Well, why not? We'd love to hear it.
About how stupid I was?
Delightful, go ahead.
When I was still in England, I worked for this large steel company. And one of the tasks I had was, I worked for one of the vice presidents, you call him here, in charge of production. One of the tasks I had, when somebody came with a weird invention to him, I was sent forth to see whether it was any good and applicable to our business. There was some nut who had a big bank of capacitors in his basement, somewhere in the middle of London. And by discharging those capacitors through a pancake coil, he could apply a shock load to a plunger, which would then blank out small parts rather rapidly in brittle materials. The materials were blanked out so fast they didn't have time to crack. And they thought that was a great idea. And he even showed me that with this pancake coil, he could, by turning it upside down, he could flip a copper disc in the air so it wouldn't come down for 20 seconds or some such. So he showed he had a great deal of impact with his coil. And I went back to my boss and said, gee, that's very curious and nice, but we're not in the electronics business, so we're not interested in blanking out small, brittle plastic parts. And as for throwing copper discs in the air, we're not interested in that either. And so we dropped the whole thing. And then the next thing I knew, I was here, and we're discharging big banks of plastic through a pancake cars and solving buckets, getting rid of imperfections. And somebody, this was a well-known effect in literature. The problem was that nobody, until after the war, there was a development of radar, could switch large currents in short times. You need electronic switching devices to switch the current from the capacitor and discharge them rapidly through something.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an independent development here, and was applied to metal forming, which of course we could have used in England. But I just didn't have the vision. I was too stupid to recognize it. And there was a little note. This thing was a very useful device for getting rid of imperfections in welded structures, which tend to buckle.
You could control it from large wrinkles down to small wrinkles and do all kinds of
things. Well, what you want to do with a wrinkle is present for a very simple reason. It's like a picture. You get a wrinkled picture if there's more paper than the frame will allow. And the only place for the paper to go is where to wrinkle up. So that the way to get rid of the wrinkles is to stretch the frame, which every painter does with the wedges in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do with a hammer is by applying this impact, you cause the metal to stretch a little. So pull out the wrinkles. In welding, you get shrinkage. So if you consider the weld as the frame of a picture, the weld shrinks and you get wrinkles inside the welded area. And so by hammering, quote, weld, you can stretch the weld a little and enough to get rid of the wrinkles. We're not talking about much, we're talking about a few thousands.
Hmm.
But and that hammer was very useful. And also you get oil canning is the same thing, that's one big wrinkle.
Mm-hmm.
But the other reason for which it was used is that we had these big suction lines, tunnels for suction lines through the tanks. And they were made by also a novel process, but they didn't turn out to be exactly the right size. They were about a quarter inch too large. And by making a coil around them, they were reduced in size. Fittings, and so could be welded without offset. So this really saved the program untold amounts of money and time.
Was it used on all stages? Was
I don't
it used more on
so.
One
than
the other?
The early ones, maybe. The techniques did get affected a little more. It was used decreasingly, but I think it was on the S1C certainly, it was used, I think, right up to the end.
Because they're dealing with such large hunks of material of
thin.
Thin
material. The stages are very flimsy, really.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the size.
Was that a unique Marshall development, that hammer?
Yeah, alas.
Pardon?
Alas.
Alas, yes, that's right, that's right. Were there any other unique tools like that you recall being used effectively in the manufacturing?
Yes, certainly the so-called strap clamps for welding. Soft tooling.
What?
Strap clamps.
So strap clamps, okay.
Where you weld two cylinders together, like in a stage, 30 feet of diameter cylinders, 10 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Build them up in the stage.
Mm-hmm.
As you make the cylinders, clearly you don't end up with the same diameter each time, to very high accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to do is, in order to make the weld, you need to compress one cylinder slightly, and expand the other one slightly. And you can do this with heavy, hard, so-called hard tooling, which would be expensive, hard to use, and generally undesirable. Or you can use it with local little clamps, which were developed here, which are very ingenious, very unique.
Hmm.
Are these little clamps that just kind of snap in with the drill hole?
No, they've got a little 5,000 steel, stainless steel strip. Screw this, jaws, I have basically Vlada's little scrap, which goes through the gap between the two cylinders, and the jaws are screwed together, and the cylinders, the pieces are aligned. Mm-hmm. Oh, you do this all the way around, and then you make tack welds, mm-hmm. and then you break the little 5,000ths, like 1 inch wide stainless steel scrap. Mm-hmm. And the thing comes apart. You can then weld all the way around, mm-hmm. and you've got the thing aligned. You don't need heavy tooling.
What are the tooling where they were using backup bars on the S2 stage to get the line? Is that heavy tooling?
Yeah, they tried heavy. They went to scrap stamps also.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
They also, for example, there's the question of whether, when welding these big cylinders, whether you should travel with a welding torch or whether you should rotate the cylinder. And the S2 stage ultimately went to rotating cylinder, although they started with skates, welding mm-hmm. skates, where the welder went around the stage. Stage turning in front of the welder.
How did Douglas do it? I forgot.
Douglas did it with hard tooling. They had horizontal.
They did.
They had hand down welds.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That was a pangyrus weld or something.
Their stage was sufficiently small, so they didn't have to build cylinders.
This concept of rotating the stage around, was that formed in the B-70 program? Have they ever done this kind of work before? Had you ever rotated the object to be welded in front of the fixed weld head?
Had who done this?
Anybody.
Well, I'm sure you do it on a lathe every day when we're welding small cylinders together. Mm-hmm. The glass blowers do it on a lathe.
Mm-hmm.
But to do it on a big stage, nobody ever built these big stages.
How were the? Was it just a rotating turntable on the base?
Yes, a rotating turntable. Very accurately speed control. You need to control your weld speed. That was a problem.
When did that come into the program? The initial
with the S1C. Here.
Yeah.
First table was here.
And then North America just picked up that technique?
No, they started. They had all kinds of problems. And ultimately, a table was made available to them. They installed it.
Mm-hmm. Was that government furnished equipment?
Yeah, I think it was taken out of Michoud. They had two down there. I forget where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just the drive motor came from, the controls came from. I forget how it was done. If you want to know Jack Franklin, there are a lot of other things, bulkhead welders, the domes, how that was done, there's some interesting techniques there.
Okay. Can you explain it?
Well, we had vacuum chucks to hold abutting segments together. But the problem is that you get one side a little hotter than the other, and so one segment lifts with respect to the other. And the development that was done here is that the two would be dovetailed one into the other, so couldn't lift. So there were two abutting segments which you wanted to weld together. The first machine, so as to have a convex and a concave edge, and then butted so that they were in fact mechanically restrained from relative movement.
Mm.
This again did away with the need for hard tooling.
Mm-hmm.
There's some very ingenious methods used and developed here.
Do you have any more little stories like that?
I think of any of them.
I guess what intrigues me is how you transferred this technology then, or how it was useful to the manufacturers. Did you send out a circular and say, hey, we've got a new way of doing this, send somebody down and look at it?
No, the S2 was very simple. Well, it wasn't simple. We couldn't transfer it. And then finally, we got various vice presidents of North America to come down here. We made two short cylinders, like 18 inches wide, and put them on a turntable with our strap clamps and demonstrated how we welded and how good the weld came out.
But you couldn't convince them to take two vice presidents down here.
Who were these vice presidents? Did you have to bring Parker down here to do that?
Root,
Ralph Root. Yeah, we wanted to talk to him when we were out there, but he was away at some meetings.
We talked to Ralph. He's a real good.
Mm-hmm. He was of the LA division, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he was transferred to the program and it got into trouble. The offset on the bulkhead was.
Can you just list some of the reasons that the S2 program got in trouble? It was kind of the pacing element for a while in the Saturn V program.
Well, I think the S2, that's a purely personal opinion. The S2, I think, is the most elegant design of any of the stages. And an elegant design in Europe is difficult to build. And I don't think enough attention has been paid to the producibility of some of this elegant design. Once it was built, it was a very light stage, structurally light, good mass fraction. And it's worked very well. I can't say anything against the S2, but it's the old story that the manufacturing people just either didn't recognize the problem or they weren't consulted sufficiently in advance to make their preparations. There were also other problems in this thing, like our contractual requirements for the primes to go to small business type subcontractors. And they chose some small business type subcontractors.
I think they ran into that trouble with the insulation.
That's right.
They just threw up their hands, and the small contractor just said, you know, just go away, we can't build you any.
That's
and
right.
I had to take it into
this
it.
Correct.
I didn't know that was a requirement of the,
it's a
the contract for the small business.
Yep.
To get it. Is there any
There's
other?
Also the trouble with the skin mill, the milled skins, the waffle pattern and the skins,
mm-hmm.
they ran the same problem.
They
sent those out to be milled and they couldn't.
That was what the Douglas?
No.
And didn't they end up milling them over at L.A.?
Yeah, I think they did.
I didn't know they
forming. They had forming problems.
Yeah. Now, didn't they do their own explosive forming down in El Toro?
Yeah, but that was also a joint development with this lab. What can be formed? What can be explosively formed? What needs to be break formed?
Mm-hmm.
How to design the parts of
Well, it was my feeling that explosive forming came in just because North America didn't have a big enough stretch press to handle that kind of
I don't think this is the whole story. You can always make a two-piece and weld it together. That isn't quite as elegant. You gain weight.
Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that explosive forming kind of grew out of army technology that they've been playing.
Explosive forming was known, but not for very large parts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can explosive form thinner parts than you can stretch press.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. Do that again now. What? You can explode thinner forms?
If you want a thin part,
yeah.
You can explode the form. If you want a thicker part,
yeah.
It's probably better stretch press.
Yeah.
Didn't they start
I
off?
Think.
Didn't they start off using some explosive forming on the that heavy part of the bottom of the bulkhead up till when they welded that first point, and then the rest is stretch pressed, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. It's the other way around.
It's
the thicker part can be a thicker part can be
explosive
form. Particularly with it has a waffle pattern in it, and the thinner part has to be stretched first.
Now, these came in flat with the waffle pattern in them. They put them in these gore segments, put them underwater in explosive form,
that's
part,
right.
And then welded the rest of it up on top.
That's right.
And Marshall had a part in that development.
Yes. North America initially wanted to explosive form the whole common bulkhead.
Hmm.
The two skins. That kind of
the whole
in
thing?
In one
the
piece?
Thing.
33 feet?
Good grief.
Again, this was before my time, so I was
a little
woozy on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course, we're woozy on the basic processes. That's where our background isn't in this at all.
Again, we had
quite a
development in stretch press. One of the problems is the grips.
Mm-hmm.
So you get an even tension. You push, you pull, and you over a form.
Mm-hmm.
You need to grip the edges. Hard material, then it gets kind of difficult to grip, get enough pull. And I think this is why you have to explosive form the heavy parts.
I see, okay, I want to ask you then why some of these things would be more desirable than others.
And others, the other thing is that they had a milled pattern. The milled pattern had to be developed so that after it's formed, it's right.
Mm-hmm.
So it changes shape while it's being formed.
Did you get into production technology in the engines as well as structures?
Some. For example, on the LM decent engine, LMS engine, one of them was built by Bell.
Yeah. but none of the Saturn engines as such.
Yeah, we had men resident at the deep hole drilling, things like that. We got involved in a bit of welding. Not really. We didn't really have that very much.
Did the
involved.
Labs have separate resident people in addition to the Office of Program Management, who had people like Don Bowden out there? And
Lambeth Grumman?
No, at North American.
Rocketdyne?
Yeah.
I don't know who. We had one man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But out of your lab?
Yeah, there was one man.
Did other labs have that practice too? So you'd have a representative program manager.
I think so. In general, I don't know specifically at the engine program, but generally yes, at the primes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they have more people than we did. But with different missions.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you, or Brenner Kurz, for that matter, did you get out into the field and examine the problems?
Oh,
there?
Certainly.
Or was this?
Of course, I'd have spent a lot of time in the air. Soon after I got here. Again, he spent the time out there. And, I minded the story.
You know, I had a question I was going to just come by me. And I realize that there are different kinds of programs, but do you think that in comparison with private industry, or at least your other experience, that the Saturn manufacturing program was well run or averagely run? It could have been less expensive, or maybe they didn't go enough here. Can you generalize?
I can always generalize it. In retrospect, you could have done it better.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this in private industry. The president of the company always said to me, "Gee, Siebel, you could have done it cheaper, you could have done it better," and I always had to agree. But under the circumstances, I think it was a fantastic achievement.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an incredible achievement. I think I don't see how. Under the circumstances at the time, it could have been done better. Could have been done differently, perhaps, but better.
Do you keep in contact with some of your former colleagues in England about, and have you talked about the different kinds of processes that you ran into here? As
not really.
To that? Yeah.
Yeah, I've been away too long.
What would you have done differently? You said you look back, you might have done something differently.
I think I would have. There's a trend in engineering generally, trend in manufacturing, the aerospace industry, which you see at several companies, where there is more and a more aggressive engineering talent introduced into the manufacturing operations. And that is true at most of the aerospace manufacturers. Some had it already, but some are introducing it. And I think this is a result of the Apollo program. It's a result of two things. One is the Apollo program. The other is a result of the fact that engineering talent is readily available to the manufacturing people today. And it's a recognition of manufacturing technology generally, which does everything from manufacturing management and interface with engineering down to the process development and actual production, that this is sufficiently technical now that one has to have an equal say with design engineering, and consequently you have to have people who can talk manufacturing and talk sensibly to design engineers. And in the evolving aerospace industry, you find that this trend everywhere. And if this had come 10 years earlier, maybe you might have avoided some.
In some ways, it strikes me you have kind of a unique viewpoint on the Saturn Apollo program, because you came in as an Englishman. Did you notice or ever hear any stories about friction between the von Braun team as Germans as opposed to the other American engineers as Americans?
No.
They had developed a very, again, close appreciation, understanding relationship.
I think it worked out.
Yeah.
I haven't heard any. Frankly, I was looking for it too.
And no, neither have I, and that's kind of why. But it's a question I'm sure John and I will be asked by some of the critical historical readers. So I always ask something like that quite often.
No more friction there than any two groups.
Yeah.
No less.
How did you see the working relationship to the lab directors around here? Did they fight each other tooth and nail under the table at times? Was there always harmony? How did that work?
There was never harmony. I think it was a constructive discord, if you like.
Okay.
I think this is misunderstanding. I guess nothing gets achieved. You have a certain amount of professional opinions,
mm-hmm.
which are not necessarily identical. And, while there was discord, I think it was entirely constructive discord. It wasn't very political. Destructive. We hate each other. Just many people. There are meetings even to today where lab directors are hitting each other tooth and nail. It just doesn't mean that we hate each other. It's just a matter of that we all do the best we can. Now you do the best we can is in this
mm-hmm.
interpreted in the same way as everybody.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, out of these, the best we can. Now you do the best we can is necessarily today where lab directors are hitting each other tooth.
On administrative role here at Marshall during your tenure?
Well, he had his own style.
His
degree, his style was that everybody could say their piece.
Uh-huh.
It was a very democratic style, if you like.
Uh-huh.
And any GS9 could go to a meeting and say, I don't agree, and he'd be listened to. And that was a great round quote system. Engineer. That was very good, and I think von Braun had a great job. Systems engineering, that's what we call it. Five somehow.
Mm-hmm. And we've had an hour.
Thank you for
thank
hour.
You very much.
The whole thing jived somehow.